Thank you, Mary. That was an incredibly generous introduction, and I appreciate it very much. And I wanted to say before this talk that it's on a number of texts. If you haven't read them all recently, I hope you just listen and respond to the larger gestures that grow out of thinking of trauma that I've been doing for some years. I wanted to just give the framework for it. I've been interested for some years in the erasure of history, not only of past history, but of our present history, which seems to me to be disappearing before our eyes. And I want to know how to think about such history and how we might witness it. Today, I'm going to talk about three different kinds of witnesses: philosophical, psychoanalytic, and literary. But I'm going to argue that all three will bear witness ultimately through the literary, and specifically through a dream. And can everybody hear me? So this talk begins with an epigraph from Toni Morrison's A Mercy. Memories of her village peopled by the dead turned slowly to ash, and in their place a single image arose: fire. In an essay of 1907, Delusion and Dream in Wilhelm Jensen's Gradiva, Sigmund Freud analyzes the novella Gradiva, a Pompeian Fantasy, as a story exemplifying the principles of psychoanalysis laid out in the interpretation of dreams. In Jensen's story, a young archaeologist becomes obsessed with the figure of a walking woman on a bas-relief he has seen on a trip to Italy. He names her Gradiva, and convinced by a dream that the woman died in Pompeii during the eruption of Vesuvius in AD 79, he travels to the ruined city in order to search for the singular traces of her toe prints in the ash. In this archaeological love story set amid the ruins of Pompeii, Freud finds an allegory for repression and the reemergence of repressed desire. In a later reading of Freud's text, the 20th century philosopher Jacques Derrida, in his book Archive Fever, Mal d'Archiv, discovers inside Freud's figure of the archaeological dig what Derrida calls an archival desire, a pain and a suffering, mal, that bears witness to the suffering and evil of a unique 20th century, and I would add 21st century history. Derrida proposes that the history of the 20th century can best be thought through its relation to the archive, a psychic as well as technical procedure of recording or of writing history that participates not only in its remembering, but also in its forgetting. At the heart of psychoanalysis, Derrida suggests, is the thinking of an archival drive that simultaneously yearns after memory and offers the potential for its radical elimination. Beginning from a general reflection throughout the main argument of Archive Fever on the nature of the psychoanalytic archive, I will argue that the texts of Freud and Derrida, read together, ultimately enable a rethinking of the very nature of history around the possibility of its erasure. Moving beyond what Derrida explicitly suggests, I will also argue that these insights about history can ultimately be understood only from within the literary story of Norbert Hanold, the archaeologist, and in particular, the story of his dream. In what follows, I will begin with Derrida's general reflections on the archive and ultimately turn to the story of the dream, which is perhaps also that of psychoanalytic dreaming more generally, to ask, what does it mean for history to be a history of ashes? And how does psychoanalysis bear witness to such a history? Part one, a burning archive. The problem of the archive as an immediate contemporary question of historical memory first emerges in Archive Fever in the opening insert where Derrida links the archive to the urgency of 20th century history. And this is number one on your handout. He says, "Why re-elaborate today a concept of the archive in a single configuration, equally technical and political, ethical and juridical? This essay will designate the horizon of this question discreetly, so burning is its evidence. The disasters that mark the end of this end of the millennium are also archives of evil, dissimulated or destroyed, prohibited, diverted, repressed. Their treatment is equally massive and refined in the course of civil or international wars, of private or secret manipulations. No one ever renounces, and this is the unconscious itself, the appropriation of power over the document, over its detention, retention, or its interpretation." End quote. The question of the archive is a question of today, of a particular historical period, a question with its own historical place, because it is linked today to, quote, "the disasters that mark the end of the millennium," end quote. These disasters are not simply the objects of archives or objects that call out for archiving. They are also themselves unique events whose archives have been repressed or erased, and whose singularity as events can be defined by that erasure. They can indeed themselves be called archives du mal, archives of evil or suffering, because they not only leave an impression, but hide their impression. They involve evil or suffering, that is, precisely because they hide or prohibit their own memory, because they are themselves hidden or destroyed, prohibited, repressed. They consist precisely in hiding themselves. They become events insofar as they are precisely hidden. The thinking of the archive is, in this sense, not only a thinking of memory, but a thinking of history, and one that marks in particular, as I will argue, the historicity of the 20th and 21st centuries. This history is not, as one might traditionally expect, constituted by events that create their own remembrance, but by events that destroy their own remembrance. Quote, "Think of the debates around all the revisions," says Derrida, "and think of the seismic movements of historiography, of techniques in the constitution and treatment of so many dossiers," end quote. This is why I would suggest psychoanalysis must be brought together with the thinking of the archive, because psychoanalysis has long been interested in the relation between history, personal and collective history, and the ways that its memory is repressed or suppressed, the ways that history is not available for immediate conscious access. Indeed, psychoanalysis must itself be understood, Derrida argues, as primarily an archival science. Psychoanalysis, I would suggest, can thus help us to think and perhaps witness a new kind of event that is constituted paradoxically by the way it disappears. Return and repetition. The archival figure emerges from and reinterprets Freud's own figure for psychoanalytic discovery, the metaphor of the archaeological dig. From 1896 onward, Freud had repeatedly represented the surprising encounter with the unconscious through an analogy in which the unconscious aspects of the mind are likened to a buried city that occasionally shows signs of its presence and eventually comes to light in analysis. But at the heart of the archaeological metaphor, Derrida notes, we also find a different kind of figure, not the figure of buried objects, but of buried writing. And this is the second quotation on your handout. Quote, "Psychoanalysis does not, by accident, privilege the figures of the imprint and of imprinting. Installing itself, often, in the scene of the archaeological dig, its discourse concerns, first of all, the stock of impressions and the deciphering of inscriptions, but also their censorship and repression, the repression and the reading of registrations, end quote. If the archaeological project is the uncovering of an object, the archival task is the reading of an inscription. In this reading, psychoanalytic discourse does not only unveil a meaning of impressions and their repressions, but also, quote, installs itself, end quote, at the heart of the dig. The psychoanalyst's act of interpretation does not, therefore, simply reveal what has been repressed, but may also repress again what has been inscribed. Quote, is it not necessary, Derrida asks, to distinguish the archive from that to which it is too often reduced, notably to the experience of memory and the return to the origin, but also the archaic and the archaeological, the memory of the dig, in other words, the search for lost time, end quote. Psychoanalysis does not permit a simple return to the origin because the impression it reads is not only left for psychoanalysis, but also left on psychoanalysis as it deciphers, as it leaves its own impression right at the site of the original ones in a new archival act, and that's also ultimately by psychoanalysis. The encounter with the archive is thus an act of interpretation that appears like a return, but is also an event that partially represses, as it passes on, the inscription it encounters. That passes on not only an impression, but also somewhat differently, its repression. The deciphering of desire at the scene of the dig is thus also the communication and repression of desire, not necessarily of erotic desire, but rather of archival desire. Quote, this fever, this presence, this desire of Freud, end quote, as Lacan described it. Through the act of its own archival drive, in other words, psychoanalysis reveals a, quote, absolute desire for memory, end quote, its own desire, and perhaps also a desire at the heart of the erotic, that attempts to return to the past, but to some extent always repeats and passes on in its very act of interpretation the ways in which the past has been erased. As a thinking of the archive, psychoanalysis thus becomes witness to the strange notion of a memory that erases, a new notion of memory that, I would argue, is at the heart of the notion of archive fever, mal d'archiv. Indeed, I would point out, Derrida's description of the archive in psychoanalytic thought alludes to a very specific and historically situated archival discovery, Freud's encounter with repetition compulsion after World War I, and his reformulation of the content and form of psychoanalytic theory around the notion of the death drive, another term that archive fever arguably attempts to translate. Freud, as we recall, described in Beyond the Pleasure Principle his encounter with a kind of memory of events that erased rather than produced conscious recall. The dreams and memories of the soldiers of World War I whose death encounters repeatedly returned to interrupt rather than enter consciousness. No longer capable of interpreting these memories as expressions of unconscious desire, Freud came to understand them as repetitions of the experiences that the soldiers could not grasp, a form of memory that, in enacting what it could not recall, also passed on a historical event that this memory erased. These memories, in other words, in repeating and erasing, did not represent, but rather enacted history. They made history by also erasing it. They were themselves archival memories because they archived history by effacing it. And in effacing history, they also created it. The soldiers became, as it were, self-erasing inscriptions of history. Traumatic memory thus totters between remembrance and erasure, producing a history that is in its very events a kind of inscription of the past, but also a history constituted by the erasure of its traces. Psychoanalysis can thus think the singularity of 20th century history, the new impression it makes, because as an archival theory, it describes the way memory can make history precisely by erasing it. The notion of the archive, as I would thus interpret both Freud and Derrida, is a change in modes of memory that is also a change in history, a change that is, quote, equally technological and political, ethical and juridical, end quote. It is this surprising change in memory and history, moreover, that is reflected in Freud's reconfiguration of the notion of the drive as a death drive. Although it is called a drive, and although it is said to be fundamental, it is also a new discovery in history, a new shift in the nature of the historical archive, whose own past cannot be traced because it is effaced, and is thus named only in terms of the way it erases the archive of memory, including the archive of its own memory. And Derrida writes of this notion of Freud, quote, "This drive always operates in silence. It never leaves an archive of its own. Its silent vocation is to burn the archive and to incite amnesia. Enlisting the infinite, archive fever touches on radical evil," end quote. Between the shock of the memory that effaces and the shock of the discovery of this memory is the event of an erasure and of a history that carries the name of the death drive, which is also archive fever, because it is made up of memory and is about memory. It is about the burning desire for memory and the history of its burning up. Part two, Freud's fever. How can psychoanalysis bear witness to this erasure beyond repression, which is new to the 20th century? We should note that the concept of archive fever and its fundamental psychoanalytic ancestors, the notions of traumatic repetition and of death drive, themselves as concepts enact a kind of return and repetition, a memory and its erasure. Indeed, beyond the pleasure principle, in its attempt to provide an economic understanding of the mind, and in particular in its return to the notion of the memory trace, brings us back to Freud's first full attempt at a psychic system, the 1895 Project for a Scientific Psychology. Derrida likewise, in Archive Fever, returns explicitly to his own earlier attempt in the 1967 Freud in the Scene of Writing to read Freud's project and to link it to Freud's later work. It is on the level of the formation of psychoanalytic concepts, then, in the way that Freud's concepts inscribe a memory, archive their own history within themselves, that psychoanalytic discourse will bear witness to the history that psychoanalysis encounters. This is how I believe we can interpret Derrida's insight about the Freudian concept. And what's interesting here is what he's reading is Freud's return and repetition of something earlier, and Derrida's doing the same thing, returning and repeating something earlier. So he says, Derrida says about Freud, "The principle of the internal division of the Freudian gesture, and thus of the Freudian concept of the archive, is that at the moment when psychoanalysis formalizes the conditions of archive fever and of the archive itself, it repeats the very thing which it makes its object." It repeats the very thing which it makes its object, end quote. The notion of the history referred to by the concept of archive is available only by studying the history of the concept of the archive, a story that occurs not on the level of a simple narration, but itself requires a new temporal and historical modality. What we find, indeed, when we return from beyond the pleasure principle to its apparent origin in the Project for a Scientific Psychology, is a concept of memory as inscription and repetition that cannot be located simply in the past of Freud's work. For the concept of the memory trace in the project itself describes a form of memory that has no simple beginning, and which is a meeting between forces that is also a breaching and inscription, the marking of a path, and the deferral of quantity. And I'll spare you the story of the neurons, but it's actually quite exciting. Memory thus originates as its own deferral and also as its later repetition, a fundamental deferral and repetition at the beginning. And this, again, is Derrida on this discovery of the Project for Scientific Psychology. Derrida writes, quote, "The concepts of Nachträglichkeit and Verspätung," so this Nachträglichkeit being the central psychoanalytic notion of deferral, deferred action, "the concepts of Nachträglichkeit and Verspätung, concepts which govern the whole of Freud's thought and determine all his other concepts, are already present and named in the project. The irreducibility of the effect of deferral, such, no doubt, is Freud's discovery," end quote. The return of the memory trace, in other words, at the beginning of Freud's itinerary, already anticipates the concept of repetition compulsion after World War I. Returning to the beginning, then, the concepts of beyond the pleasure principle repeat and erase this past, erase it to the extent that Nachträglichkeit, deferred action, no longer operates as a term within this later text, precisely at the moment that repetition and delay nonetheless dominate its notion of human history. Indeed, the concept of Nachträglichkeit is the central concept, I would argue, that Derrida attempts to rename in the concept of the archive. This psychoanalytic concept of deferred action, in my interpretation, enacts its own deferred action and its own repetition throughout Freud's career. But in doing so, it also both records and effaces its own past, and to a certain extent, becomes erased from the psychoanalytic archive. We can see the self-archiving and self-erasing act in Beyond the Pleasure Principle, where the notion of a deferred experience is newly figured as an attempt to return by consciousness. This is after, in the context of trauma, an attempt to return by consciousness that ultimately fails and departs into the repetitions of a future history. Trauma, and ultimately life and the drive itself, is an attempt to return that instead departs. This figure, this concept, this story, the story we recall of the child who plays Fort Da, there, here, with his reel, is about memory and history. And it is also the concept archiving its own history as it returns and departs from its origins. The psychoanalytic concept, I am trying to suggest, archives its own history, and in doing so, bears witness to the newness and alterity, to the shock of a history it cannot assimilate, but only repeat. The 20th century history to which psychoanalysis bears witness through its own historical unfolding is the intersection of these two dimensions, of the concept that repeats and of the memory that erases. Which is also to say that what Freud shows us in the peculiar unfolding of his own discourse is that the history of World War I can be understood precisely as a history constituted by the erasure of its own memory. Disappearing history. In the structure and history of its concepts, Psychoanalysis thus registers the impact of a new self-erasing history. To cite Robert J. Lifton, psychoanalysis is itself a survivor of World War I. But this survival, which gives psychoanalysis, we might say, its own survivor mission, its mission to witness not only individual but also collective history, is a collective history that is beginning to disappear even as it is being produced, is also structured by the principle of Nachträglichkeit, by the passage into the future that constitutes all traumatic experience. Indeed, the concept of return and departure, so central to Beyond the Pleasure Principle, will repeat itself in Moses and monotheism, now as the story of Moses attempting to return the Hebrews to Canaan. The Hebrews murder him and depart traumatically into the future of Jewish monotheistic history. At the center of Archive Fever, this story, which Derrida addresses through an encounter with the Jewish historian Yosef Haim Yerushalmi's book Freud's Moses, Psychoanalysis Terminable and Interminable, will return once again as a story about psychoanalysis. What brings Derrida to this book by Yerushalmi is the question of whether or not psychoanalysis is a Jewish science, a question that for Yerushalmi means that it is a science of and always opening up to the future. But the return and departure that constitutes the survival of the Jews in Moses and monotheism, read as a traumatic, archival history, is also the story, I would argue, of psychoanalytic thought, which ultimately conceives both the erasure of the history it witnesses and potentially the erasure of its own history. That is, the very history of psychoanalysis as witness. This is why I believe Derrida ultimately turns to this work and to Yerushalmi's book to talk about the question of futurity that lies not only at the heart of all trauma as deferral and future repetition, as an attempted return that instead departs, but also lies specifically at the heart of the archival history of psychoanalysis at this moment of its conceptualization in Vienna in the late 30s. If psychoanalysis, in its thinking of Nachträglichkeit, witnesses a history that is constituted by the erasure of memory, then Freud also, I would suggest, in Moses and Monotheism, conceives or narrates the possibility of a history constituted by the erasure of its own witness, a history that burns away the very possibility of conceiving memory, that leaves the future itself in ashes. Part three, psychoanalysis in the ashes. Yet, at this very point in Archive Fever, in the ashes of history, at its site, another story is told, the story of the German writer Wilhelm Jensen's Gradiva, a Pompeian fantasy, and of Freud's reading of this novella in Delusion and Dream in Wilhelm Jensen's Gradiva. We turn back in Derrida's postscript to this earlier Freud text, written in 1907 after the interpretation of dreams, to discover an encounter between Freud and a dream, or rather, between Freud and a literary text about dreams that returns us to the site of a disaster and to the site of literature, to the site of literature as archive. To recapitulate the story briefly, it is, as you will remember, the story of a young German archaeologist, Norbert Hanold, who becomes obsessed with the plaster cast of a marble Roman copy of a Greek bas-relief he has found in Italy and managed to purchase upon his return to Germany. Enthralled by the position of one of her feet, he names her Gradiva, that she who walks, and having become convinced in his fantasies that she was from Pompeii, he decides after a dream that she was buried there during the eruption of AD 79. he ultimately returns to Pompeii to search for her traces in the ash. And encountering a woman he believes is Gradiva's specter, engages in a series of conversations with her that finally bring him to the realization that she is in fact his old neighbor, Zoe Bertgong, for whom his desire is now finally and consciously aroused. Freud, who had traveled to Naples in 1902, thinks of Gradiva when he thinks of his new science, after encountering in the story by surprise his own discovery. And this is the number 3 on your handout. And this is Freud. There is no better analogy for repression by which something in the mind is at once made inaccessible and preserved than burial of the sort to which Pompeii fell a victim and from which it could emerge once more through the work of spades. Thus it was that the young archaeologist was obliged in his fantasy to transport to Pompeii the original of the relief which reminded him of the object of his forgotten youthful love. That would be Zoe. The author was well justified, indeed, in lingering, verweilen, over the valuable similarity which his delicate sense had traced out between a particular mental process in the individual and an isolated historical event in the history of mankind. End quote. The analogy of burial and preservation by which Freud had in 1896 characterized his own discovery of the unconscious is rediscovered here in a literary text in a particularly self-reflexive way. First of all, as a figure used unconsciously and symptomatically by the main character, the archaeologist Norbert Hanold, a figure that represents his own unconscious processes. And second, as a figure used by the author of the story, who traces out the similarity between the burial of Pompeii and the process of the mind. Character and author are thus both tracers of footprints in the ash of a catastrophe. They linger, verweilen, at this moment of discovery, a pleasurable erotic lingering, and also one tinged, perhaps, with a Faustian threat. Freud, too, we could say, as a lover, not of a woman but of a science, confronted by Jensen's text, is reminded of the forgotten object of his youthful love. Psychoanalysis, or a piece of psychoanalysis, a piece of its historical, if not material, truth, which, by analogy, he must not only make emerge once more through the work of spades, that is, dig up with pleasure as an archaeologist, but must also trace out, pursue with fright in the ashes. Freud's encounter with this text, therefore, does not involve an act of recognition, but rather a repetition, an outbidding, in Derrida's word, Sorensher, that burns with a passion for discovery beyond that of the character Norbert Hanold. Yet Hanold himself is already no longer an archaeologist, but rather an archivist. Quote, "Hanold burns with archive fever," Derrida writes. "He has exhausted the science of archaeology. This science itself was of the past." End quote. Hanold returns to Pompeii not in order to return to life, the life of Gradiva and ultimately the life of Zoe, but rather to find Gradiva's singular traces, something he comes to understand in the story in a moment of memory. At this moment in the story, Hanold stands alone in the silent streets of Pompeii, which suddenly seems peopled by the dead. And this is the fourth quotation on your handout. And this is Derrida describing this moment in Jensen's story. He writes, "Hanold understands everything. He understands why he had traveled through Rome and Naples. He begins to know what he did not then know, namely his intimate drive or impulse. And this knowledge, this comprehension, this deciphering of the interior desire to decipher, which drove him on to Pompeii, all of this comes back to him in an act of memory. He recalls that he came to see if he could find her traces, the traces of Gradiva's footsteps, end quote. Hanold does not wish to see Gradiva, but to revisit what makes her memory possible, the traces of her steps. Remembering traces, I would suggest, he thus also understands or theorizes belatedly. Like the Freud of both The Project and Beyond the Pleasure Principle, he attempts to return to the origin of his own memory as the origin of Gradiva's traces. As I would interpret this moment, staged by the philosopher as a moment of conceptualization, of theorization, that echoes Freud's own belated creation of psychoanalytic theory, Hanold thus wishes to return to the possibility of Gradiva's memory, to what will guarantee that she is memorable in the future, that she can no longer be forgotten, erased, excised from the archive, that her impression will remain and her history will intertwine itself with his. In Freud's own act of encounter with Hanold's trace, I would also argue, in repeating Hanold's gesture, Freud feverishly repeats or outbids Hanold, for he too attempts to return, but does so in Hanold's and his own future. He attempts to return to the possibility of another memory, that of his own love of his youth, psychoanalysis, as the very possibility of testimony. Derrida writes of the moment in Jensen's story of feverish conceptualization, quote, he dreams this irreplaceable place, the very ash, where the singular footprint, like a signature, barely distinguishes itself from the impression. And this is the condition of singularity, the idiom, the secret, testimony, end quote. Hanold's dreaming and Freud's after him, I believe, raise urgent questions, questions beyond their concepts, beyond the fever of conceptualization, at this burning site. How can I bear witness, Hanold wonders? How can I guarantee the memory of Gradiva? How can I bear witness? How testify, Freud unconsciously thus asks, to the trace of psychoanalysis, that is, to the very possibility of finding traces, to the very possibility of memory, in the ash of this conceptualization and in the ash of this memory. Burning dreams. Hanold, at this site, quote, dreams. He dreams the very ash, end quote. What does it mean to dream? If we look at the larger context of the passage to which Derrida refers above, we notice that the object of Hanold's memory, of his reason for coming to Pompeii, is in fact a dream. Even while Derrida writes that Hanold dreams, the actual dream of Hanold to which he alludes is to a certain extent effaced from the philosopher's text, as the dream is also effaced from many critical texts on Jensen and Freud. It is then a dream that repeatedly recedes into unconsciousness, though it is, I would argue, at the very heart of Jensen's story. This is Hanold's first dream of Gradiva while still in Germany and the first moment that he actually sees her. I quote the entire context of the passage from Jensen in which Hanold in Pompeii comes to remember this dream. It begins as he stands in Pompeii Street, and this is number 5 on your handout. Hanold looked before him down the Strada di Mercurio. Then suddenly, with open eyes, he gazed along the street, yet it seemed to him as if he were doing it in a dream. A little to the right, something suddenly stepped forth, and across the lava stepping stones, which led from the house to the other side of the Strada di Mercurio, Gradiva stepped buoyantly. As soon as he caught sight of her, Norbert's memory was clearly awakened to the fact that he had seen her once already in a dream, walking thus the night that she had lain down as if to sleep. With this memory, he became conscious for the first time of something else. He had, without himself knowing the motive in his heart, come to Pompeii to see if he could here find trace of her, end quote. Hanold's act of remembering the reason for his trip to Pompeii is part of a complex scene of dreaming and awakening, beginning with his feeling as if he were in a dream before she suddenly appears, and culminating when his memory is awakened to the fact that he had seen her already in a dream. Hanold's remembering his moment of conceptualization is a belated awakening to the fact of his seeing her as a repetition, the repetition of a previous dream, which appears after the fact, that is, to be a dream of following traces. This frightful dream indeed appears to constitute the figurative center of the story, and thus a kind of originary moment of Norbert's history. The dream, in fact, constitutes Norbert's first sighting of Gradiva, as well as the place in which she is also first sees the destruction of Pompeii. And this is number 6 on your handout. Quote, in it, he was in old Pompeii, and on the 24th of August of the year 79, which witnessed the eruption of Vesuvius, the heavens held the doomed city wrapped in a black mantle of smoke. The pebbles and the rain of ashes fell down on Norbert also. As he stood thus, he suddenly saw Gradiva a short distance in front of him. Violent fright, Schreck, forced from him a cry of warning. She heard it too, for her head turned towards him so that her face now appeared for a moment in full view. At the same time, her face became paler, as if it were changing to white marble. Hastening quickly after her, he found his way to the place where she had disappeared from his view, and there she lay, as if for sleep, but no longer breathing. Her features quickly became more indistinct as the wind drove to the place the rain of ashes. When Norbert Hanold awoke, he still heard the confused cries of the Pompeians who were seeking safety, end quote. Confronted with this frightfully anxiety-producing dream, Freud suggests that it is an anxiety dream illustrative of his dream theory. The anxiety of the dream and the destruction of Pompeii illustrate the repressed and returning erotic desire for Norbert's long-forgotten neighbor, Zoe. Freud thus reads the dream through the archaeological metaphor as both the burying and painful partial reappearance of desire, a wish fulfillment. Yet, Freud's interpretation has an uncanny effect, for the dream is thus not only read archaeologically, but also becomes thereby a staging of its own formation, a staging of the burial of Pompeii, which is the figure of repression. This dream, in other words, appears both to figure and to narrate the process of repression as an origin. It is a dream of the origin of dreaming, of the possibility of knowing and not knowing, of figuring without consciousness, a mode of witnessing that originates in a catastrophe. What kind of origin is this dream? Freud himself, at the end of his essay, famously adds an odd afterthought about another motive for the dream. Quote, this was the wish, comprehensible to every archaeologist, to have been an eyewitness of that catastrophe of 79. What sacrifice would be too great for an antiquarian to realize this wish otherwise than through dreams? End quote. The wish to be an eyewitness of catastrophe is Freud's wish here expressed on the level of manifest content in the dream. But Freud also, I would suggest, sees and doesn't see something in the witnessing that the dream narrates, an origin and a catastrophe that is not exactly a burial and not simply of the past. Indeed, the figure of the destruction of Pompeii is not simply or not precisely a figure of burial, since the peculiarity of this singular historical event is that the destruction occurred not simply through burial, but through burial by ashes, which is also a burning up, a destruction that does not simply preserve, but may also totally incinerate the bodies it buries. And for those of you who are not aware, Pompeii was buried by tephra, a mixture of ashes and rock. And then in the 19th century, Fiorelli, who was in charge of the site, drilled holes down through this tephra. And those holes went down to some vacant areas where the bodies had been as they died. And he poured plaster down through those holes. And then he brought the plaster up. And that's why we have these figures of the dead and dying in very, very detailed form in plaster from Pompeii. So they were not buried bodies. The bodies had disintegrated. And they created forms. And those forms then got filled with plaster. And that's why we have these very striking images, plaster images of Pompeii. At the origin of the figure of repression is the possibility of a complete erasure, which the archaeological analogy of burial and preservation and the concept of repression that it shapes itself erases and bypasses, passes over to pass on. Indeed, as a narrative, the story of the dream tells not only of a burial, but of Gradiva's walking, stepping, and of Norbert Hanold's following of her steps. Step after step, the dream narrates a tracing of steps, which Hanold will remember later when his memory is awoken as the attempt to find the singular traces of her toe print in the ash. The tracing is both Norbert Hanold's then and also the author's, who had linked the singular destruction of Pompeii to the process of the mind, which is also Freud's fine sense as a theoretician whose concepts must also be figures, and often literary figures. Indeed, what Freud sees and doesn't see in this dream, what he attempts to return to but must repeat and erase, I would suggest, is the origin of his own theory of dreams, not only in the interpretation of dreams, but rather also in the memory traces of the project. These traces of the past of Freud's own theory, are also traces of the future, insofar as the dream, a dream of burning, that is also an awakening, points us toward the other kind of nightmares, the nightmares that awaken, which are the traumatic dreams of Beyond the Pleasure Principle. In these ashes, the figure that dominates is not so much what Freud points out, but rather, as I see it, the figure of the trace, or even more, the action of tracing, the step after step, gang. This echoes throughout Freud's text in the historical event, Vorgang, that is also an event of destruction, Untergang, in which Hanold follows the steps of Gradiva, but ultimately finds Zoe Bertgang. But what exactly is the figure of a footstep in the ash? How can ashes sustain a print when ashes are precisely that which may disperse and drift away? And what would it mean to leave a trace or a remainder in that which is itself a remainder, the ash that is the burned-up trace of what is incinerated? The figure of ash itself is indeed not only the substratum for a writing that has taken place, but the figure of a writing that is burning up. On the site of these ashes, Freud writes a new kind of language. Faced by the dream, he is stirred to seek a saving figure in Zoe, whose name means life in Greek. But he gives us, in fact, another kind of figure, the imagination of an unimaginable erasure that is carried, I would argue, by all of his figures of deferral, of repetition, of return and departure, of Nachträglichkeit, of trauma. The language of trauma is the language of this absolute erasure, not imaginable in the past or present, but always as something missed and about to return, a possibility always of a trauma in the future. This is what it means to say, I would suggest, that the traumatic event is its future, is its repetition, as something that returns but also returns to erase its past, returns as something other than what could ever recognize. A singular and new event, but in this case, in Freud's facing of an event in the dream, an event that undoes everything we have thought of as events as history because it is a future event that undoes its own future. In his burning mission, I would ask, does Freud become witness to the ashes that surround him or endure as the remainder that psychoanalysis may also become? Cinders are indeed, quote, incubation of the fire lurking beneath the dust, end quote. To burn with archive fever, does it mean to bear witness or to be ash? Strange witnesses. What indeed is the language or figure of cinders, which is the language of Jensen, of Freud, and of Derrida, if it is the, quote, annihilation of the capacity to bear witness, end quote? What of the readers, for example, who read the figure of ash? We are indeed, Derrida suggests in response to such a question by Elizabeth Faber, quote, strange witnesses who do not know what they are witnessing, witnesses to something they are not witness to, end quote. I would suggest that there is something we could call the language of ashes, which is perhaps a new kind of language that is for us today, marked historically, at least since the middle of the 20th century. Indeed, the figure of ash also refers us to events that may not have a simple referent, but are signs of the unimaginable past or the unimaginable future, a future which, as the psychoanalyst Elaine Carruth once remarked, quote, hovers as a silence over every psychoanalytic session, end quote. Which is why the figure of ashes, though without a simple referent, is without question marked by this 20th century historicity, this exposure that is now the condition of our history, and why it is, in a literary text, a text that itself has no single referent, a text that can figure what it cannot think, that in both the psychoanalyst's work and in the philosopher's work, these ashes and this strange witness by Freud and Derrida first emerge. We could indeed translate archive fever in its postscript into a kind of allegory, installing Derrida's French philosophical language at the heart of Freud's German psychoanalytic archive. Quote, this is Derrida, by chance, par chance, I wrote these last words on the rim of Vesuvius, right near Pompeii, less than 8 days ago. For more than 20 years, each time I've returned to Naples, I've thought of her, Gradiva, end quote. Derrida's reading of his own burning conceptualization of the archive, born from this reading of Freud and Jensen, thus takes place from a thinking of chance by a movement within philosophy toward the incalculable. Quote, who better than Gradiva, I said to myself this time, the Gradiva of Jensen and of Freud, could illustrate this outbidding in the Mal der Schief, illustrate it where it is no longer proper to Freud into this concept of the archive, where it marks in its very structure the formation of every concept, the very history of conceptualization, end quote. The origin of a history, the possibility of conceptualization, of thought, which is also the condition of the possibility of memory, and thus of history, only happens to be thought by chance. It is the singular event of chance from which is born the chance of a writing and of the writing of a new origination of thought after the end. But in inscribing his own writing on the rim of Vesuvius and at the heart of Freud's psychoanalytic archive, Derrida also, perhaps unwittingly, retells his own theoretical work very like the story of Hanold, who returns to Pompeii to seek after Gradiva. The philosopher thus writes his theory inside the literary story of Norbert Hanold, duplicating Hanold's return to Pompeii, which is where the actual sighting of Gradiva takes place, through its chance meeting of Gradiva or of that something that first passes by his eyes as he stands in the burning streets of Pompeii precisely at midday. The thought of Gradiva is not only Derrida's thought about the Gradiva of Jensen and Freud, but also a Hanold-like thought of her. The chance takes place within the literary text, and only insofar as Derrida, like Freud, encounters but also misses something crucial that he sees and does not see, the importance of the dream at the very heart of Jensen's story. In this way, Derrida's interpretation not only impresses its own trace upon Freud's and Jensen's texts, but is in its turn impressed upon by them, impressed into their service, we could say, as the site of witness where chance thoughts and chance words arise. They arise as archive fever, but also as a literary fever, beyond and below the concept, beyond and below the feverish attempt at conceptualization. In order to understand this language, however, we must also recall that Hanold's story, the literary text of Wilhelm Jensen, is itself first told within a dream, the dream of Norbert Hanold, which is the dream of returning to Pompeii and seeing Gradiva, by chance, in the ashes. I submit that the philosopher, in turn, can be said to be dreaming throughout the entire work of Archive Fever from its first pages. Quote, "I dream now," he says at the beginning of his work, "of having the time to submit for your discussion more than one thesis. This time will never be given to me," end quote. From following traces to writing in the ashes, this is not only the trajectory of the concept of the archive in its burning, dreaming conceptualization. It is also the trajectory at the very figures of these burning conceptualizations, all these authors as themselves signs or dreaming figures. And in a very brief last section, the footsteps of psychoanalysis. And there is an epigraph to this from the contemporary French psychoanalyst Françoise de Voine's essay, The Characters of Madness in the Speaking Cure. She says in the middle of that, "I too am dreaming." We may indeed read by chance, emerging from the dream in Jensen and repeated in Freud, the mark of a footprint. The first appearance of Gradiva in Pompeii is marked by a single word set off typographically in a separate line, a typographical separation that makes an immediate impression, plötzlich, suddenly. And it returned to number 5 on your handout. Hanold looked before him down the Strada di Mercurio. Then suddenly, with open eyes, he gazed along the street. Yet it seemed to him as if he were doing it in a dream. A little to the right, something suddenly stepped forth, and across the lava stepping stones, which led from the house to the other side of the Strada di Mercurio, Gradiva stepped buoyantly, end quote. This word, suddenly, also appears in Hanold's first vision of Gradiva in his dream, and proliferates across Jensen's text and into Freud's after its appearance along with her image. Suddenly is, of course, the language of the unexpected, of the accident, of fright, of the event marked by trauma. It is also here the word of a chance meeting, an encounter that will also be, in Freud's reading, the beginning of a psychoanalytic process of encounter, or we could say, the beginning of a certain kind of unprecedented witness. The suddenly thus emerges as an accident, mere chance, the beginning perhaps of a figure and a future concept, but one that arises from and must always return to the dream, to the site of chance meetings, and to the enigmatic language of the literary. This word, then, emerging from the dream, may be the trace of the trauma, perhaps the footprint of Gradiva or of psychoanalysis, as it leaves its footprints, or as it may simply be disappearing, suddenly, imperceptibly, at the heart of its own burning, in the history of its writing, in the history of today. And I close once again with some words from Toni Morrison's A Mercy. If you never read this, no one will. Or perhaps no. Perhaps these words need the air that is out in the world, need to fly up, then fall, fall like ash over acres of primrose and mallow. Thank you.